The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Cass Sharon with Disability Rights North Carolina. For the next half hour, I will be talking with one of Disability Rights NC's litigation lawyers, Lisa Grafstein. Lisa and I will be talking about a historic ruling in one of the cases DRNC filed and won on behalf of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, known for short as IDD. The case is commonly referred to as the Samantha R. case because a young woman named Samantha R. is the lead plaintiff in the case. The state is now appealing that order, and we want to give you all the details. But before we dive into that, I want to quickly introduce you to Disability Rights NC, also called DRNC. We are an independent 501c3 nonprofit organization and a member of the National Disability Rights Network. As I mentioned, my name is Cass Sharon, and I'm on DRNC's communications team. I've been with the agency for 15 years in various positions and absolutely love what this committed, passionate team of people accomplish on behalf of people with disabilities, always with the needs and desires of disabled people centering our work. And we do a wide variety of work on behalf of the nearly 3 million disabled people throughout North Carolina. You can learn a lot about that work we do on our website, which is disabilityrightsnc.org. Okay, back to the lawsuit and the judge's historic ruling in November. Lisa, let's set the context for the lawsuit by focusing briefly on all the work DRNC does on behalf of people with IDD, some of whom are blind or have low vision. So first of all, maybe could you tell us who are people with intellectual and developmental disabilities?
Sure. Thanks, Cass. People with IDD may have an intellectual disability. The term developmental disabilities is a broader category of disabilities, and it can include physical, intellectual disabilities, or both. So some examples of developmental disabilities include things like autism, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, fetal alcohol syndrome, spina bifida. So those are a few that might give you an idea. The commonality of these disabilities is that they tend to manifest first in childhood and be disabilities that sort of are with a person through the whole span of their life.
Great. Thank you, Lisa. DRNC does a lot of work for kids and adults with IDD in a lot of spaces and ways. So, for example, we work in coalition with other agencies and stakeholders and people with IDD and the state about issues affecting people with IDD. We fight employment discrimination. We work to interrupt the school-to-prison pipeline for kids with disabilities. We represent kids and adults when services are cut, to help them get the services back or even get the services to begin with that they need to help them thrive and live in their community of choice. We help kids and adults move out of institutions and into their community of choice with the supports and services they need. We also have the federal authority to go in and monitor conditions in institutions where people with IDD live to ensure that the facilities know the rights that the residents have and that the residents know the rights they have in those facilities. And while we're there, we monitor and investigate for safety to identify, prevent, and remedy instances of abuse and neglect. And we work to ensure legal compliance, safe conditions, and appropriate services. We also identify children and adults who tell us that they want to live in the community with supports and try to help them do that. We investigate deaths and allegations of abuse or neglect, and we advocate for systemic reform. So in short, when I think about our work with IDD and also for work for all people with disabilities at our agency, we monitor and investigate in facilities, we undertake individual representation, and we engage in public policy advocacy to ensure the rights of kids and adults with IDD and all disabilities are advanced and protected. And when these efforts can't solve the systemic issues that we are seeing and that people with all kinds of disabilities tell us are barriers to their success, we can litigate. And that's where Lisa Grafstein and our team of litigators come in. So, Lisa, for people who may not be familiar with the legal system, and even people who may be, tell us what litigation is. What is that about?
Sure. Litigation is when one party, we represent plaintiffs typically, that's the party that's bringing the lawsuit, will pursue a claim against one or more defendants to try to vindicate their rights. And it could be their constitutional rights, it could be rights that are developed under statutes, under federal or state law, but it's where you file your papers in court and you have a judge or a jury decide the dispute between the parties and whether someone's rights have been violated.
So can you give us some examples of maybe some recent cases or successes?
Sure. At Disability Rights, we really focus on systemic litigation whenever possible. And that's because, you know, as you mentioned, Cass, there are 3 million people with disabilities in the state. We have 20-something lawyers at Disability Rights North Carolina. So we can't really bring individual cases for everybody who might have a legal claim. So we try to do the cases that really have a broader impact. So an example recently is, you know, we had a case in 2020 that was about voting rights, and it was actually voting rights for people who are blind or low vision. And that lawsuit was based on problems in the voting system, where if you wanted to vote absentee, you'd be sent a paper absentee ballot that was standard print and was not in any way accessible for folks who were blind or low vision. So we filed a lawsuit, and we asserted that those claims in federal court, and a federal judge issued relief on behalf of all people who are blind or low vision in North Carolina. So it really enables people to have a broader impact. Even folks sometimes who don't know that we exist, we're out there litigating on their behalf. And we also litigate individual cases when there is going to be a precedent that could be set by the case, or when it's also going to have a similarly wide impact. So, for example, we litigated a case recently for a man who uses a service animal and who was being trespassed from a mall, and the police got involved. And so we felt like there was an important issue there with police involvement in those situations, and were able to litigate that case and come to a resolution in a way that's sort of a model for other police departments across the state. So those are the kinds of issues that we bring. I will say we as you mentioned, we have other means of advocacy. We do try to resolve things prior to litigation for a lot of reasons, one being it just takes longer to litigate a case. People want results sooner rather than later. But also there's just every case involves a lot of time and effort that we want to be really careful with our resources because of all the work that needs to be done across our state.
And I've seen that it is a lot of work. You guys are very, very busy with all this, with the lawsuits and keeping them all straight and all the papers that are involved. I'm glad you talked about that it's like sort of a last resort, because from my perspective, I see y'all, you know, we talked about the public policy piece, like we try to work with the players to try to resolve things in that sort of way. And we only at the last thing that we have that we will do is pull this trigger if we need to. Right.
Right. Absolutely.
So let's talk about the Samantha R case. And, you know, we talked about individual representation, like in the case of the man with the service animal. In Samantha's situation, we actually did represent her individually before we got into the systemic litigation case. So we also do that type of representation, like I mentioned, about getting the services that people need. And that broke down, didn't it?
right, absolutely. And that is where some of our cases come from, when we're trying to get someone what they need. And a lot of times what happens is, in the course of these individual representations, you start to pull back layers and you're uncovering why someone's not getting what they need and problems that are really systemic and that are not individual problems. And that was certainly the case with Samantha herself.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the Samantha R case. What is it about?
Sure. So the Samantha R case is fundamentally really about access to community-based services for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, or IDD. And what that sort of looks like is, a lot of folks, depending on their disability, may need some supports to live in the community. So as we mentioned, there are a lot of disabilities where someone might need support. So, for example, if you have a cerebral palsy, you might need assistance with activities of daily living. If you have autism, you might need supports for employment or for getting in the community. So the case is about access to those services so that people can live in the community. The federal law provides that if a state is providing services, the services have to be provided in the community if they're also being provided in an institutional setting. So let me back up a second and say, historically, lots of folks with IDD have lived in institutional settings, and I'm going to ask you about that in a minute, Cass, because that's your expertise. But they have lived in institutional settings for much of our history, and But the case law and the federal law says that if you're providing those kinds of services, you have to give people an equal access to live in the community. And that's what Samantha R is about, is making sure those services are available to live in the community.
So tell us about the plaintiffs in the case. Introduce us to the plaintiffs.
Sure. So first there's Samantha. Samantha is in her early 30s now. She is somebody with significant intellectual and developmental disabilities. She was living at home with her folks for about 26 years, and they provided a great deal of care for her, but also had services available through Medicaid, through programs that are available to folks with IDD. But over time, what her folks were experiencing was that Samantha's services were being cut, to the point where they really could not support her at home anymore. And so reluctantly, they agreed to let her be admitted to an institution, a state-operated facility. And then from day one, they began trying to help her leave that facility. But it took us quite a while in the lawsuit to get her out. She's now living in the community in a group home, getting the services and support she needs to sort of live her life in the way that's best for her.
I remember reading the paperwork on her admission where her parents signed and said, we're doing this because we have no choice. This is not where we want her to be. It was such a poignant thing to see on that paperwork.
Right, and a lot of families get there, and you know, that's why we had to bring the case that we brought, because it wasn't just Samantha. Certainly it would have been enough, but it's happened to so many families.
Yeah.
Another plaintiff is Marie, and Marie is somebody, as you mentioned, our monitoring earlier, disability rights, it wasn't me, but it was, actually, I think it was you, Cass, and one of our other, and Gabby, who found Marie living in an adult care home, and she was really not being well cared for, to say the least. She was being over-medicated, she was in a state where she really was not functioning, and she was about 26 years old, I think, at the time, and Gabby and others on our team were able to get her into different settings and to finally work with her to get some attention medically to her, to the point now where, through the course of the litigation, she's now living in an apartment. She's getting supports in the community. She's getting those community services we've been fighting for. So rather than, you know, she was actually at the adult care home. They had ordered a wheelchair for her because they had had her on so many drugs that she was really not able to she wasn't safe to walk around. So that Marie's doing well now. Connie is another individual who lives with her mom, and her mom is a great advocate for her and a big support. Connie was facing issues of getting her services cut because of the failure of the state to really provide sort of an adequate scope of services for somebody with high needs like Connie. So she was facing cuts to her services that were really putting her at risk. And that was also true for Mitchell, who's another plaintiff, who his mom, again, a very good advocate for him. Mitchell was really facing service cuts that were based not on his needs, but on based on sort of artificial budgets. And then there's Jonathan, who was living in a group home, but really not getting what he needs. He's deaf and needed a better setting for him to live in that was more accessible to his family and more community-based. So all of those folks are getting what they need at this point, and through the litigation have really gotten better situations. But, you know, as I mentioned, the case really was for all people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. These five really are good examples of how the system affects people's lives.
Yeah, in various different ways. Yeah. So there's this thing I understand called the Registry of Unmet Needs, called the RUN.
Right.
Tell us about that, because that features significantly in the remedy that the judge ordered in the case, right?
Right. So thousands of people with IDD in North Carolina are just not getting the support that they need. And for some of those supports, there's a waiting list that's called the Registry of Unmet Need, which is very kind of bizarre phrase. It's sort of something out of a futuristic novel, I guess. But anyway, the Registry of Unmet Need is really a list of people who are not getting the services and supports they need. It has grown over time. When we first started this case, there were 11,000 people waiting for services, and they were waiting for, I think the average was 7 or 8 years at that time, which is way too long. Mm-hmm. Now there are 16,000 people on that waiting list. It grew during the course of the litigation. Now there are people waiting more than 10 years, and that's the average. Some people have been waiting twice that. So it's really unacceptable if you think about the idea that somebody is diagnosed, for example, with a developmental disability when they're a toddler or 5 or 6 years old. Mm-hmm. To wait 10 years for services for a developmental disability really is that gives you kind of a sense of what families have gone through and what people have gone through waiting for services. So the retrieve I need is a huge piece of the case and a huge piece of the remedy, and really something that folks are very focused on because it is so impactful on people's lives.
Mm-hmm. And one of the issues with people being on the Registry of Unmet Needs is not just the size of it right now, but those are the people who know to get on the list.
Right.
There's an untold number of people with disabilities who don't even know that they could possibly get on the list.
Right, exactly. Yeah. We really don't know what that number is, but what has happened over the years, we've heard lots of this anecdotally, is that folks will not bother to get on the list because they've heard mm-hmm. that the wait is so long. And yeah. it's really unfortunate because the list, at least now, it didn't used to be this way. It used to be by level of need, but now it really is just sort of first come, first serve. So mm-hmm. a lot of folks really, I think, missed out on that opportunity. I expect that there will be a lot of other people who will come forward and say that they also need services. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I hope they do, because we really need to have a better picture of that, don't we?
Absolutely. Yeah.
One of the issues with all of this that we've been talking about is that some people can wind up in institutions, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I guess that's something we really have not talked about in detail yet, but Cass, maybe you can speak to this a little bit more, and I will just shout you out that in addition to being a great communications person over the last few years, you spent a lot of years working in institutions and doing that investigations and monitoring work. So maybe you can help set up what kinds of facilities we talk about when we talk about monitoring and, where we have access to, and then maybe also, which ones of those relate to Samantha Haar specifically.
Okay. Good. We have federal authority to access in any setting where a person with disabilities receives services. So that could be schools, jails, prisons, adult care homes, like we mentioned where Marie was, group homes, nursing homes, psychiatric hospitals, locked facilities, psychiatric facilities for kids called psychiatric residential treatment facilities, PRTFs, what's called ICFs, which is the short term for intermediate care facilities. So mentioning the ICFs and the adult care homes, those are the two types of facilities that are at issue in Samantha R when we talk about institutions. And so adult care homes are assisted living facilities. People go there typically to get some services that they might need that it's difficult for them to access in their home or in their community. They were initially licensed and regulated by local DSS agencies because they were seen as sort of the old folks' homes in the local counties, where auntie or uncle or grandpa would go. They've since become something very different from that, although some of them still do have that model. ICFs are these intermediate care facilities are for facilities that need for people who need 24-hour nursing care. And they can be, both ICFs and adult care homes can be smallish, like 6 beds or fewer, or they could be 10 to 15 beds, or they could be more than 100. Some of them are quite big. And some people in facilities that we think about, like assisted living facilities, they go there when they're retired, and there's a lot of socialization and great food, a lot of choice of activities. But most of the facilities that we are in are not like that. In fact, we focus our efforts in facilities where the quality of care is not very good and where we want to make sure that people are safe. What we typically see in these facilities is very little privacy, lots of sound noise. I remember going in the facility where we found Marie one time where they were playing the song by Kiss that's called Beth, and it was being played at such an extreme volume. And to this day, every time I hear that song, I think about that moment when I was in that facility. Lots of staffing issues, very little choice about when you eat or go to bed, lights on, lights out. When you get your meds, it can be not private at all. I've seen people lined up in the hallways. There is a fair amount of abuse and neglect. People are quite isolated from their community, and some folks don't even have access by phone or by email. So things that really take away a person's autonomy, in short. We have 9 minutes. So we think about, people talk about the burrito test, which is this measure that we think about it, whether something is an institution. And the idea is if you can get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and make yourself a burrito or a cup of hot tea or hot chocolate, or for me it would be popcorn, or have someone else do that for you, then you're likely not in an institution. But if you cannot do that, then you are in an institution. And the idea is that you would have the freedom to control when you eat, what you eat, and make other basic decisions about yourself. So that's the idea behind institutions and what they're like. Did I cover things correctly, Lisa? Is there anything else you'd want to know?
No, I think that covers it. I think the regimented aspect of it, I think, is an important piece, that it's not, it's not always just about, there certainly is abuse and neglect, as you well know, but for a lot of people, it's really just being able to live their own lives. And, for example, Samantha's family didn't feel like she was being in any way abused or anything like that in the state-operated ICF she was in. It was really just wanting to live her life, not the life that happened to be set out on the schedule that day.
Exactly. So getting back to Samantha R., as the case was advancing, how did it go? What was the state's position?
Sure. So we did a lot of what's called discovery. We took depositions and got documents from the state. And, what we found was that there was broad agreement that amongst state staff, and really the state, the official sort of state position itself, was they agree that they are over-reliant on institutional settings. I mean, they've said that explicitly. So there was broad agreement about that. There was broad agreement that most of that it comes from the fact that there are not adequate access to community-based services, that a lot of folks would like to leave the facility they're living in. Some folks don't, but some folks would like to leave, but they just don't have the services available to them in the community. We also learned, when you were talking about ICFs, you mentioned, the level of care needs there. The Registry of Unmet Needs, the services that people are waiting for are services that are really the same level of care. So when we talk about community services and institutional services, I think it's important to point out there's no, and this is something that the state has said to us, their staff have said to us, there's no sort of clinical difference between people institutionalized or people in the community. What's different is who has access to community-based services.
Right.
That's really the bottom line. And that a lot of the idea of some of the, so we have, in terms of ICFs, we have three state-operated facilities, which are larger institutional settings, and then we have privately owned ones. And that there's, a lot of question about, whether some of the privately owned ones are really serving people who truly have a higher level of need. There's something called cherry picking that everybody sort of seems to understand is going on, which is that, if you're getting paid a certain amount to serve people, you might want to serve people who have lower needs. And so we're not necessarily seeing that people in institutional settings are across the board higher needs than people in the community. So I think that's an important distinction for people to know. So your question, though, about where the case was, that's what we learned in discovery. And in 2008, we felt like we had a good handle on what needed to happen, and we reached out to the state about, 2018. So we filed the case in 2017. 2018, we reached out to the state and gave sort of a detailed idea of what we thought needed to happen and asked them to convene stakeholders and people really with an interest in the system. And we thought we could, as we mentioned earlier, get it resolved more quickly and at the, with the least litigation possible. But unfortunately, we really did not get good feedback from the state on that, and we had to keep litigating the case.
So tell us about the judge's recent ruling, just briefly.
Yeah. So, in 2020, the judge ruled that the state is, in fact, in violation of the law by keeping people institutionalized and not offering enough community-based services. And then more recently, in November, the judge issued a ruling essentially laying out benchmarks for the state to meet. He actually gave them that intervening 2.5 years to come up with a plan to figure out how to serve people, and because they did not come up with an adequate plan, he imposed some benchmarks, which included eliminating that waiting list, making sure people have the option to get out of facilities, and doing some other things to make sure that community services are available, such as, really developing enough providers to make sure that people can be served. So that's what the order required, and it gave varying time frames, but the order really was a 10-year period to try to move us in the right direction to get people what they need in the community.
So between 2020 and when the judge issued the ruling in November, the state didn't give any plan that they could use to how they could be in effect with the judge's ruling?
Well, the state published what it calls an Olmstead plan, which an Olmstead as a whole, that's sort of the federal case that addresses this issue. But the Olmstead plan, the judge examined that, and we gave the judge some information about the Olmstead plan. It did not address, it did not eliminate the waiting list. It didn't have any provisions for moving people who wanted to leave, people with IDD who wanted to leave. And so it really did not adequately address the underlying concerns of the case.
So the state appealed.
They did.
And, you know, you said earlier that the state pretty much agreed when you were taking depositions and doing the legal work. So why did they appeal if they were, in essence, in agreement of what the issues were?
Well, you know, of course, this is my perspective, right?
Okay.
Understand, but you know, everybody agrees that the problems need to be solved. What the state, I think, has pushed back about is the accountability. They have said that they're going to do it on their own terms and in their own time. Of course, that's not a direct quote, but that's essentially what they've put out, that they have a different plan than what the judge has told them to do, and so they want to move forward. We've looked at that plan. It's not adequate in the same ways that the prior plan was not adequate. And we're just asking them to live up to what they've already said they would do. And so we're hoping that we can continue this dialogue and that, you know, ultimately we believe we'll be successful in the appeal and that this is really just, you know, unfortunately more delay, but we continue to try to work with the state to get people what they need and not get caught up in the legal back and forth.
Gotcha. So this will probably add at least a year on with the appeal.
Right.
Okay. So what are some other areas that DRNC is litigating right now, Lisa? A little foreshadowing for next month's legal matters.
Right, yeah. So there's, in addition to another kind of institution that we didn't really talk that much about was psychiatric residential treatment facilities. So they're called PRTFs, where children sometimes are institutionalized. And that will be, that's a case that we filed recently about kids who are in custody in those situations and circumstances that are harmful to the children involved and that don't meet the needs of the kids who need support for their mental health disabilities if they have them. And these are kids in foster care who really are being sort of warehoused in these settings unnecessarily.
So I've read the lawsuit, and so some of these kids are sent to other states, right, as far away as Utah and places far away, right?
Right, exactly, which is, you know, obviously problematic because we don't have access to them to monitor to see if they're being treated well. Their families don't have access to them. We really have no accountability for what's happening with these kids in other states. And even in the PRTFs in our own states, there have been lots of conditions uncovered that really are deeply troubling for anybody who cares about kids.
Mm-hmm. We have a section on our website about PRTF, so if folks want to learn more about that, please go to our website and just type in PRTF. So we are going to be closing up this particular issue of legal matters. Thank you, Lisa Grafstein, for being here. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Cass Sheeran with DRNC, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.